And the other element that I wish to say is also in the same one. Therefore, he says, whoever before discipline in the former part, that is to say before praxis, right, passes eagerly, not to say slothfully, to that second part, that is to say contemplation, because of its sweetness, brings to pass the anger which God breathes against him. This is because before he has put to death his members that are on the earth, namely before he has healed the sickness of his thoughts, or patiently enduring the labor and shame of the cross, he has presumed to imagine in his mind the glory of the cross. And this is what was said by saints of old. If the mind desires to ascend the cross before the senses cease from weakness, or before the senses cease from their infirmity, the wrath of God will come upon it. The ascent of the cross that brings wrath is not the first part, that is the endurance of afflictions, which is called crucifixion of the body, but the ascent of contemplation, which is the second part. Indeed, the one who, while his mind is defiled with shameful passions, hastens to imagine in his heart illusory ideas about the future and about the divine, will be silenced and will be silenced with punishment. For the things of God come of their own accord when you are not aware of them, if the pupil of your soul has not been purified, or if the place of your heart is pure, I'm sorry, if the place of your heart is pure and undefiled. Let me read that again. For the things of God come of their own accord when you are not aware of them, if the place of your heart is pure and undefiled. So, this is, it's as key to the understanding of contemplation that it's the end of prayer. So we have purification, and we have illumination, and we have theologia, or union with God. And the purification part is really the struggle with the passions. It is said in this tradition that there are four transformations leading to union with God. The first is from praxis to dispassion. That's what we've been talking about. The second is from dispassion to natural contemplation, or in particular, second natural contemplation. The third is second natural contemplation to first natural contemplation, and the fourth is to the contemplation of the Holy Trinity, or theologia. Now, I need to obviously talk about natural contemplation. We've been talking about the move from praxis to dispassion. We understand that. We understand where we are in it. As a matter of fact, that's one of the keys of prayer, said by John of the Ladder, as well as in the 19th century by Theophan the Recluse, and throughout, is that as soon as you get down to pray in this way, whatever you are, whatever you wherever your true state will be made known to you. Your true state before God will be made known to you if you try to pray. If you try to pray in this way. And that's what all of those distractions are. And that's what why everything comes into your mind that's not been purely healed or dealt with as soon as you really try to pray. As soon as you get into your cell or your room or whatever, you know, area where you're actually just trying to pray before God, then all those things start to pop up. Now, instead of going, oh my God, all these things are popping up, you should say, good. This shows me where I am. All right, I shouldn't have this feeling about this person. Lord, have mercy, forgive me. You see, then immediately you start to, you know, go through the laundry list and get rid of them. Or at least say, forgive me for them. And then what are you doing then? Then you are practicing, you are actually purifying yourself and you're preparing yourself in consciousness. You are being consciously aware of unconscious sins, things that you were sinning without being fully aware that you were sinning. But as soon as you try to pray before God in this way, whatever sins that you have done that you have not been aware of, those are the ones that are going to pop up, and they'll pop up as distractions. Now, they may not seem like sins. They may be a book you've read. They may be a magazine article. It may be a newspaper article. They may be, it could be anything. And there's nothing particularly sinful in that. But again, we say that the heart of this practice, the heart of this psychology of mental prayer, is really the practice of understanding temptation and overcoming it. Understanding temptation and overcoming it is really the key. That's why I gave you that handout for the last class with the four, with the models of temptation. Because those are the, those have to be understood now on a much more subtle, a much more interior level. Not massive temptations, not, sort of the gross corporeal temptations, but much different ones. And that goes with the idea of that I talked about, that if you really want to pray, it comes from Evagrius, Chapters on Prayer, where he says, if you really want to pray, do nothing that will inhibit prayer, and then God will draw near to you and travel with you on your journey. That's where that idea comes from. You learn to think ahead. You learn to think, what's this going to do to my prayer? I mean, I like to read novels. But if I read a mystery, if I read something that's not in accord, that novel will show up in my prayer life. It'll actually show up. I'll start thinking about the plot, you know, or where I am with it. And then, but if you take to heart this idea about prayer, about doing, if you want to pray, but actually doing things in accord with prayer, you'll think about it ahead of time. And maybe you won't pick that up at that time. Maybe it's not necessary. Say you're working at a job and you have your break. What are you going to do during your break? Well, there's a novel sitting around. How about if I read the novel? Okay, I read the novel. I spent 15 minutes of my break, and then I'm back to work. Nothing. I've never. It doesn't bother me during all day long. But as soon as I sit down and do my prayer rule, or want to do my prayer rule, that novel will show up. And scenes in the novel will show up, and the language of the author will show up, and I'll have to fight that off. In a way, that's why a true desert dweller will run from those impressions, because all of those are impressions. And as we said before, it's impressions that are lodged in our memory that start to come up in prayer. And some of them are not necessarily evil in themselves. But when you are seeking to pray, when you are seeking to draw near to God, when you are seeking to have communion with God, an actual vision of Him, divine vision, contemplation, those things are going to show up. And you have to make a decision. Do you want to pray like that, or don't you? Do you want to make that a real goal in life before you die? Or are you going to, you know, do the best you can, but you want to keep those things, you want to keep those pleasures? That's what St. Isaac was talking about. And St. Maximus will also do that. In fact, I should probably read the little thing from St. Maximus, where he talks about that. And remember what I said about the senses and the one single sense of the soul, and about how the senses in a way divide the one single sense of the soul, which is oriented on a divine vision. When the intellect, the nous now, regards the senses as its own natural power, it becomes entangled in the superficial aspect of sensible things and devises ways of enjoying the pleasures of the flesh. Now here he does not just mean sexual pleasures. The pleasures of the flesh essentially means anything that can happen as part of our embodied state. And you know, you can make up a list as good as I can. It is unable then to transcend the nature of visible things because it is held back by its impassioned attachment to the senses. It can sometimes happen that the intellect is unable to advance to the apprehension of the noetic realities akin to it. the noetic realities akin to it are the contemplations that are possible to us. There is a world of a vast world, far vaster than this world, of divine visions, of spiritual contemplations that is possible to us, that is available to us. But we either only hear of it or we have tastes of it, when sometimes we'll receive intuitions or sometimes we'll receive inspiration. That's from that world. But this, the heart of our mind, the nous, that part of our mind that can apprehend things directly without mental reasoning, direct apprehension. God gave us that power. It's meant to go to Him. That part, that essential mind, nous, a part of ourselves, is akin to these noetic realities. It's meant to contemplate. It's meant to contemplate. Except by way of the contemplation of the intervening sensible objects. But such contemplation is impossible without the senses, which are linked to the intellect, yet are naturally akin to sensible objects. Now here he is talking about what St. Maximus the Confessor calls second natural contemplation. Or there's natural contemplation, physiki in Greek. Natural contemplation is the direct fruit of prayer. And it is part of our direct path to God. It's called natural contemplation. It's the English word, the English phrase. It's not really very good, because you could call it contemplation of nature, but if you call it contemplation of nature, you'll think of the Romantic poets and Wordsworth, and you'll think of wandering through the woods and hearing Beethoven's Fifth, Movement 2, and all of that. Now, that's wonderful in itself, but that is not what is meant by natural contemplation. Natural contemplation is a fruit of prayer in which your sensibility, your consciousness is raised to the extent that you can actually see and experience something of God in the natural world. In every element of the natural world, you can see God's trace. St. Augustine talks about this, the traces of God. You can see God's trace. But this is the right use of the senses. Because this is what he's talking about when he says that the contemplation that's attached to the senses is the contemplation that senses these things of the natural world, but still is aware of God through them. And it is not just a matter of our own personal enjoyment. You see what I mean? The difference? See the difference?
Yeah.
The difference is that you can go out into the world, you can go out into nature and enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And you should. But it is not second natural contemplation. But if you are going out in a prayerful state, you are going out seeking something of God, seeking God's footprints, seeking God's presence, and you are at the center, you are thinking through the heart, then you can have this experience through the senses, but it's a contemplation. But it's not the highest contemplation. But it's still far higher than most of us get to as long as we're not practicing, right? That's what he means by second natural contemplation. And that's also what he means, and St. Isaac means, when he says that we have to be purified, not of the senses themselves, but of the way our soul is captivated by sensuous experiences. That's why, for example, the Orthodox tradition teaches that we should not seek for, say, the sensuous experiences of angels. We should not seek for a physical experience of angels, because we will probably be deceived. Now, it may happen that God will send an angel as a grace to us, but we should not seek it. You'll find this, for example, in the Arena, the wonderful book by St. Ignatius Brainchaninoff. He will talk about that. So what St. Maximus calls first natural contemplation is a higher state of contemplation in which the your consciousness, your mind, is raised above the sensible world entirely, so that what he calls intelligible realities, that all come from God, that are on the realm of the angels, are now, in a way, a smorgasbord before our gaze. When we are in God's presence and when we are praying, this is another fruit of prayer. You can see that there is a very distinct understanding of contemplation here. Very distinct, very clear. It is something that comes out of prayer. It's not something you just do. It's something that comes out of prayer itself. It's a gift, as St. Isaac said. Okay.
Can you say that again? The first natural contemplation. Can you define it again?
Okay. It is, according to this tradition, which derives from Evagrius through Maximus and others, and Gregory Palamas, it is a fruit of pure prayer, and it is the divestiture of the senses, so that whereas with second natural contemplation, you actually need you need the sensible object. You need the object before you to experience the contemplation. A tree, for example. You need the tree as a way to experience the contemplation. Whereas in first natural contemplation, which is akin to the noetic world, the world of the angels, what's called the intelligible world, you have transcended the senses. You have transcended the world of the senses. And you are living in the world of the spiritual senses, the spiritual senses of our being, which are, in a way, they're analogous, but they're not exactly analogous to the physical senses. And all of the great fathers like Maximus and others will talk about the spiritual senses. In reality, awakening these spiritual senses can only occur through the purification of our being, through praxis, through struggling with our passions. But then it's part of the elevation, because ultimately the goal of Christianity, the goal of our being as of Christians, is to experience the ascension. This is all part of the ladder. What that ladder is not just getting better at prayer or becoming a better person. Yes, it is those things, but it's not essentially those things. It's essentially experiencing the divine initiation of the ascension, going with Christ to the ascension. And there are these degrees of prayer which is the ladder that goes up to heaven. And according to this tradition, I mean, once you are in the place of contemplation, there may be many degrees, but they essentially see two basic degrees, and those are the ones we're talking about. The degree in which you are contemplating, but you are still through the sensible world, through the senses, through the experience of things, but seeing God's purpose in those things. And not only seeing God's purpose, in a strange, unique way, seeing, in a way, God's presence in and through those things. In and through one another, for example. We need one another to see God in one another. To see Christ in one another. You need that other person who looks at you and you look at him. You can't see yourself, but you can see the other person, right? Mm-hmm. And he can see you. So you're a gift of God to that person, or to all these people. And all these people are a gift of God to you. And the higher you go into contemplation, the more you realize that God is present in all of those people, no matter where they might think they are. And you begin to experience a kind of wonderful bliss, a sweetness. It's the true experience of the sweetness of contemplation and prayer. And we're capable of that. We are meant to have that experience in this life. But there are great dangers, I constantly have to mention that, if we think that we can do that without this understanding of spiritual practice. I mean, as St. Maximus says, the five general contemplations. Now, the five general contemplations are the Holy Trinity, the contemplation of the intelligible world, the contemplation of the sensible world, and then providence and judgment.